This is Digital Story Podcast number 524, March 22nd, 2016. Today's theme is the HDR dilemma. I'm Derek Story. The biggest frustration I've had with photography has been the disconnect between what I see with my eyes and what the camera records. Even with today's technologically advanced machines, my pictures don't always turn out the way that I envisioned. So what are the techniques we can use to tip the scales in our favor? Raw capture is certainly a good start, but high dynamic range photography elevates the possibilities to a new height. And that's the first topic on today's show. The HDR dilemma. I call this the HDR dilemma for good reason, because it seems like every time I consider this shooting technique, I have this internal conversation about the pros and cons. So on the plus side, HDR photography can help us capture the images that we envision in our brain. And that's pretty spectacular, really, because if you consider what's going on with our optical nervous system and our creative vision, and then you hold this, you know, $200, $500, $1,000 device in our hands and say, you know, do the same thing. You know, that is pretty wild, really, when you think about it. That is pretty impressive. So, you know, that is the good part. Capturing the detail in the highlights and those shadowy textures and how they can all coexist in one image is very exciting. So considering that this can be done using HDR technology, high dynamic range technology, what's not to like? Well, there are a few things to consider on the negative side too. Now, before I get into those, I should talk a little bit about HDR technique in general, right? So we're all on the same page here. So how do I shoot HDR these days? Well, I have a little button on my camera, on my OMD EM5 Mark II that says HDR on it. And I press that button, and when I do, the camera fires off three frames in rapid succession, one at negative one, one at zero, and one at plus one, or sometimes it's negative two, zero, and plus two. Depends on how I have it configured. And it does that very quickly, so there's as little movement as possible between the three frames. So we end up with an underexposed frame, an overexposed frame, and then one at the reading that the meter dictates. And those three frames then are uploaded onto the computer. I don't do any processing in camera. You can. There are some cameras that allow this. Mine does. But I like to have more control over the processing than what the camera can do. And as you'll see when we get into the things to look out for with HDR technology, you know, just letting the software decide what the image is going to look like is not the way to go. At least that's my opinion. So what I end up with are the three frames. Those three frames go into a software application. So if you're using Lightroom, you have an HDR merge built right into your application. And it's quite good. I mean, I've written an ebook on it, and I think in the scale of HDR applications, it is on the side of photorealism. So it doesn't really do the overdrive. It doesn't really do the things, the cartoonish effects. It you know, it stays away from that and really just tries to do photorealism. And then there are all sorts of applications in between. I've tested a lot of them. And the one that I'm using these days is HDR Pro, Aurora HDR Pro by Macfoon Software. And it's very interesting. It was created in partnership with Trey Radcliffe, who's one of the people who have made HDR either famous or infamous, depending on how you want to look at it. He is definitely an HDR guy. And he worked with Macfoon to create this application. And I actually like the application a lot. And so it's what I'm using these days. I like it for a couple reasons. It's a good standalone application. It handles my Olympus and Canon RAW files quite well. It's also a plugin for photos for OS X, and I like that. I like having a plugin when I'm just, you know, kind of doing HDR on the go. So it's a good app, but you have to be careful with it, as we'll get into, because you can make some crazy stuff with it. So anyway, you take these three images and you put them in whatever application you're using. And then the application, first thing that it does is that it merges them. And really what that means is that it's reading the highlights and the shadows and it's creating one image, utilizing as many of those tones as possible. After that merge happens, and some auto alignment too, even in rapid succession, there can be movement unless you have your camera on a tripod. And, you know, that's how we used to shoot HDR in the past. We'd always put our camera on a tripod. But I don't like carrying tripods all the time. And apparently a lot of other people don't like carrying tripods all the time. So that's why camera manufacturers, you know, figured out how to give us HDR without using the tripod. And, you know, really what they're trying to do is just make that frame rate as high as possible when shooting HDR images. Now, once you have the master file, then the software allows you to interpret it in a variety of ways. You know, and it depends on what software you have. With Aurora HDR Pro, there are tons of presets. Basically, what I do, to tell you the truth, is that I click on preset batch, like photorealistic, and then I just click on the different presets and sort of get a feel for, you know, what's capable with that image. And that's helpful. You know, just kind of knowing where the edges are. Once you do that, then you can fine tune it using sliders, you know, color sliders and luminosity and softness and HDR effect and all that good stuff. And then you output it. So then the application, you know, bakes in all this information and your changes and everything, and then it creates the one file, outputs it. And that's what you can share and post on Flickr and put on your blog and make a print of, do whatever you want. So that's what's going on with high dynamic range photography. So far, so good, right? Why do I have this dilemma? Why do I have this internal dialogue right before I shoot a shot? And I know about this very well because I just had it the other night. I was shooting at the Artisan Cheese Festival in Petaluma, California. It's at the Sheraton, which is right on the marina there in Petaluma. Yes, Petaluma has a marina. There's a river, Petaluma River comes in there, and it's a very nice marina at that. That night, we were in this big tent, this big giant tent, and there was food and wine and beer and lots of cheese going on, music, the whole deal. And it was getting around twilight, so I say to myself, I could use some fresh air, take my cameras, go outside, see what's going on. And you know what? It had been a storm, and the storm parted, and wow, it was pretty nice out. So then I spend, you know, the next 15, 20 minutes of my break taking pictures. And I had my film camera with me. I had my digital camera with me and had my iPhone with me. I mean, I was just shooting everything, right? That's what I do. I just, when I have the time, man, I just shoot everything. This one shot that was down by the dock in the marina was really nice. I mean, it was postcard nice. And, you know, I put it on Instagram, not an HDR version, just a straight shot. I'll be honest with you, I try to stay away from that, but sometimes I just can't help myself. That's an underlying subtext for a lot of things in today's show. Just can't help myself. And then I was going, wow, I wonder how this would be as HDR, because you had this vibrant sky with these big clouds. You had water with the reflection. You had this wooden dock perspective. You had boats, you know, wow, you know, come on. So I said, all right, I'm going to do it. I tried to shoot the best shot I could first, and then I did HDR. So I turned on the HDR button on my camera, on my OMD, and it went bing, 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 right? And under, over, and a proper exposure. And I ran them through the HDR software, and they were just too over the top. I mean, really, even with the mildest preset I could find, you know, like the boring photorealistic preset, it was still too over the top. And so I said, you know, okay, it's not working on this. And really, I got the best results just from a regular RAW file where I played with highlight and shadow detail. I had the dilemma. I did the thing. And then I rejected it. So, okay. So let's talk about, you know, some of these cons that make the dilemma. So first of all, there's more post-processing than with other images. So, you know, literally, since I'm using mainly Photos for OS X and Capture One Pro and Capture One for my RAW files, so that takes me outside of my workflow, my normal workflow, and then I play with the images, and then I put them back in. So that's one of the things that I'm thinking about, which is I'm not going to shoot HDR all day today, because if I do, I'm going to have a ton of post-processing. So that is one thing I consider. How much post-processing do I want to do? I think about that when I take the shot. And with HDR, with me anyway, it's usually a good 10-15 minutes of fooling around with just one image. And then there's finding the right HDR processor. And again, you know, this sounds simple, but it isn't. I mean, I've been looking at HDR processors for a long time. I'm still not sure I found the right one. I like Aurora, but I don't know. Is it perfect for me? I don't know yet. You know, I like what Lightroom does, but sometimes, in all honesty, it doesn't do enough. I like what Aurora does, but in all honesty, sometimes it does too much for me. And then, you know, there's all the ones that I've played with in between. So, you know, spending the time to find the right HDR processor, that is a consideration if you're going to shoot HDR. And then there's the expense, right? Because, you know, not only do you have the time investment to figure out which one, but, you know, ultimately you're going to buy one of these things and they cost money. So that's another part of the HDR dilemma. Now, here's a biggie, the next one, knowing when to stop. And this sounds so easy, but HDR creates the classic trap that if a little is good, a lot is better. And anyone who's ever processed HDR knows exactly what I'm talking about, right? You know what I'm talking about. So, you know, you have probably a pretty good shot, and then you go, wow, what if I just, you know, bump it up a little bit more? What if I just saturate it a bit more? What if I add a little more glow? What if I do this or that? And you just keep doing it. And then the next thing you know, you've got this wacky thing that doesn't look like the photo at all. Hopefully you can go back, or sometimes you just got to start all over. And then, you know, so then there's another 20 minutes, right? And, you know, I don't know, more than any other post-processing technique that I do, HDR sucks me into this thing where I don't stop. And when I need to, I learn to just need to stop. Like, I should set a timer. I should try this. Set a timer at 5 minutes. Wherever I am at 5 minutes, that's where the image should stay. Right? Then I hit export and I send it out and I move on to the next thing. I might actually try that. That just now dawned on me while I was talking. Set a timer when you do HDR processing. Because otherwise, if you're anything like me, if one cookie leads to a dozen cookies, and you know what I mean on this, it's so dangerous. And then you just end up with gobbledygook. So knowing when to stop is a big deal. All right, here's another thing. Avoiding the HDR stigma. And I think this is real. I don't think it's just in my head. But it seems to me that if other photographers know that you used HDR processing on an image, they discount it. They discount it. They go, you know, you used HDR. No serious photographer would stoop to this, right? If you shoot RAW with manual exposure, then I respect you. If you put it in a program with HDR, then, you know, you're not a photographer. You're just a, you know, you just play with tech toys and software and let all the machines do the work, and you're not doing anything. So it's almost like you have to hide the fact that you use HDR processing. Otherwise, you know, they discount your work. And I think that sucks, because you know how I feel about this stuff. I think that tools are tools. And, you know, if you have a vision and this tool helps you achieve it, then you should be able to use it. Then finally, here's the last one, part of the dilemma, which is fighting laziness. And I think this is real too. So, you know, when you're having this conversation and you're looking at this scene, let's say this marina scene, you go, okay, am I going to really, you know, dig into the scene and figure out, you know, the best way to expose it, the best composition, nail that color, you know, all that kind of stuff? Or am I just going to shoot it with the HDR button on and figure it out later? Or even worse yet, let the computer figure out later. And I do think that HDR photography can lead to laziness if you let it. Watch out for that. Don't start saying, you know, I don't need to worry about color. I don't need to worry about exposure. All I got to do is shoot it in raw HDR mode. And then, you know, later on we'll figure it out. That is not going to make you a better photographer. And you know what? Then you're totally reliant on post-production. Let's say that you're shooting all HDR and you're standing out there on the dock. And if you're a gal, this really handsome guy walks up to you and strikes up a conversation and wants to see your pictures. Or if you're a guy, this really beautiful woman strolls up to you and wants to see your pictures and you want to impress him or her, right? Well, believe me, looking at under, over, and regular exposures on the LCD screen in the back of the camera is not going to impress anyone. Seriously, you just, you know, looking at a checkerboard, right? Not that I, you know, think this should be the driving force of your photography, but you get the point here, right? You get the point. Whereas if you're a real craftsman and you've been finely crafting your frames, and then you show that person, you know, the back of the LCD with, you know, beautiful image after beautiful image, then they're going to think you're a real photographer. So maybe those people back at the HDR stigma, you know, maybe they're right. You know, right? Maybe they are right. I don't know. So what's the bottom line here? What, all this being said, I do like high dynamic range photography. I don't use it all the time. I mean, really, I probably shoot in HDR mode a couple times a month. When I do, I really like it. And sometimes I really can produce images that I don't think I could have produced any other way. Spend some time finding the right HDR software for you, practicing with it, being able to set your camera up quickly for it, and sort of refining your technique so that when you are presented with a situation, your dilemma will be, is choosing HDR for this particular shot the right thing or not? It won't be worrying about, well, how am I going to process it and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Get all that worked out, have your system down, and then your dilemma won't be nearly as bad when you're presented with an HDR opportunity. In the news, Apple announces the new 9.7 iPad Pro. And this was covered by the Digital Story, that well-known news outlet. So this was today, the day that I'm recording this. Apple had their special event, and they announced the new 4-inch iPhone and a new version of iOS and the 9.7-inch iPad Pro. This iPad Pro is a beauty. It really is. I'll give you just a few of the specs right now. So it's fast. It has a 64-bit A9 chip. It has Hey Siri. And you know what Hey Siri is? Hey Siri is actually kind of cool. I have it on my iPhone 6S. And basically, you just you have to turn it on, and it's in the general preferences. And then it makes you say Hey Siri a few times and say a few phrases to kind of get your voice. And then when your iPhone is off, or in this case your iPad, you don't have to turn it on or anything. You just say, Hey Siri, and you know, you ask a question, and then Siri takes care of it for you. And it really saves you a lot of fooling around with your device. So anyway, it has Hey Siri, and if you have a modern iPhone, you should play with it. I think it's kind of neat, actually. The display is brighter, 25% brighter. Has the lowest reflectivity in an iPad ever, which means, you know, when you're looking at the screen, and especially when there's a lot of ambient light, you know, you won't see your face or your nose reflected as much as you have in the past with other iPads. Has a wide color gamut. Has a True Tone display. This is new, which basically the device reads the color temperature of the room and then adjust the image accordingly, same way like when you're looking at paper. So if you're reading a book in a room and the lighting's really warm, well, the paper's going to be a little warm. If the lighting's really cool, the paper's going to be cool. Instead of having this disparity between the ambient light and the light of what you're reading. So that's what True Tone does. It sort of matches the display of the iPad to the ambient lighting in the room. It looks pretty neat. I'd like to try that in person. Four-speaker audio. 12-megapixel EyeSight camera that also shoots 4K video and also has Retina flash. 5-megapixel FaceTime camera, live photos, and really super important, it's Apple Pencil compatible. So, I mean, this is a pretty cool device. Now, what's it going to cost you? Well, a 32-gigabyte model will be $599. 128-gigabyte model will be $749. And a new 256-gigabyte model will be $899. And there's four different colors, including rose gold. And they'll be available March 31st. So that is pretty nifty stuff. I tell you, it's a very tempting device. I'm weird, though. Like, this is where sometimes I'm too weird for my own good. What I want now is I want the iPad Mini Pro. I do. I want all this stuff that they're talking about here in an iPad Mini form factor, because the iPad Mini just fits in all my nimble camera bags. And I used to have the larger iPad, the 9.7. I like the 9.7. I love working on it. I just don't like carrying it around all the time. So I'm holding out for the iPad Mini Pro. But for those of you that aren't as weird as me, this new 9.7-inch iPad Pro looks like a real winner. Autumn in the Eastern Sierra, October 21 through 23, 2016. So within a week, I'm going to send out the invites to the folks that are on our reserve list for the last workshop of the year, which is the Autumn in the Eastern Sierra. This is the first year ever that I haven't done Safari West in fall color in Sonoma County. So we are going to roll the dice and we're going to go out to the Eastern Sierra. Basically, we're going to do what we did in June last year, but we're going to do it in the fall. So we're going to go to Bodie. We're going to go to Mono Lake. We're going to explore all the wonderful areas of fall color with the quaking aspens. I'll tell you, it's one of those things. If we hit it right at June Lake and Grants Lake, it's spectacular. It's really crazy. We have a great place to stay. We stay at the Silver Maple Inn in Bridgeport, and we have a meeting room in a 1800s, in a refurbished 1800s house that is so comfortable and so charming. It'll just knock your socks off, really. So I'm really looking forward to this. I think this is a very exciting event. If you wanted to do fall color in the Eastern Sierra, you didn't want to necessarily do it by yourself, but you want to do it with other photographers, and you want to enjoy all the benefits of a workshop. The instruction, the camaraderie, the good food, the hospitality, you know, where all that stuff is just taken care of for you, then you definitely want to consider this workshop. Now, if you're not on the reserve list, you can get on there before I send out the invites. All you have to do is go to our workshops page and use the Send Me Info form, get on the reserve list, and then you'll be in that first wave. And you'll have an opportunity to sign up for the workshop. As with all of our workshops, space is limited. I'm going to keep it to 7 or 8, just because I think it's a better workshop experience. As some people say, you know, we do the boutique approach to workshops. We're very hands-on, very personal. Just want you to have this fantastic experience, both with your photography, but also with other photographers. So just go to the TDS workshops page. Go ahead and do Send Me Info. Those of you that are already on the Send Me Info form, be looking for the invites, and I hope to have them before the next podcast. Alrighty. And those of you that are on the reserve list, I hope to see you in the Eastern Sierra this coming fall. I think it's going to be spectacular. Tell us your film story. So you've probably heard me remark in passing that I'm working on a new site. I'm really excited about it. And it's called The Analog Story, which I just love this. So we have the digital story. We will always have the digital story. Digital story will always remain the main site, the flagship site, the home for the podcast, all that good stuff. But the analog story, I want to complement the digital story, where it's going to focus on film photography, technique, workflows, equipment. It's going to have a used camera store in there, all sorts of good stuff. And I know we have a lot of film photographers in our audience. So here's what I'm asking. What I'd like to do is feature people who still shoot film or who started shooting film and find out basically why. Why are you attracted to film photography? And then what gear do you use? And then share up to a half a dozen pictures. And then I want to post these stories on The Analog Story. So I want it to be 500 words or less and 6 pictures. And basically why you're shooting film photography. Show us some pictures and then tell us the gear that you like using. You can pull this all together and send it to the Gmail address, theanalogstory@gmail.com. Theanalogstory@gmail.com. And then over time, you know, publish them on the site. I'll have maybe one or two published when I debut the site. I'm hoping to have the site launch within a month. And this will be an ongoing thing because I think it's interesting what draws people to film photography. And I think those stories and those pictures are going to be fascinating. And whether you want to shoot analog or not, you might be interested in seeing why these other people do and the images that they're creating with it. It's theanalogstory, all one word, at gmail.com. And I look forward to hearing from you. All right, let's do a few updates. I have a webinar coming up with Capture One, and it's called In Aperture Exile, Easing the Change to Capture One with guest Derek Story. So I'm going to be a guest on this webinar on April 13th at 9 a.m. It's free. And what I'm going to be talking about is my experience moving from Aperture to Capture One Pro, some tips that I have, why I chose Capture One Pro over other things such as Lightroom. And it's going to be fun. And, you know, David is great. I've been listening to his webinars since I got interested in Capture One Pro, and now it's fun that I'm going to be on one. So that's April 13th at 9 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And there's a link to sign up for this webinar, this free webinar, in the show notes. And there's links to everything else. I encourage you to go over there. I encourage you to join me on April 13th if you've been an Aperture user. It's going to be fun. We're going to have a great time. I also want to remind you about Out of Chicago, and it's coming up for me on June 23rd. That's when we have our first workshop. June 24th, we have our second workshop, and then the conference itself, all in Chicago. And there's a link in the show notes if you want to sign up. One workshop sold out, and I believe the second workshop still has some seats. And we're going to do the Nimble Photographer there. It's going to be great. We are going to have such a blast. And out of Chicago, I start on June 23rd. And then the conference rolls on for a couple days after that. And finally, a big thanks to our friends over at Red River Paper for their support, not only with Out of Chicago, but this podcast. And for really helping me continue to explore that creative side of me. And instead of having to stand in the dark room, which I don't like doing, I did it for years, I can now use this wonderful fiber-based paper by Red River, use my inkjet printer, and create stuff that is just marvelous. And it just, you know, takes me back to, printing on fiber-based paper in the dark room. but without the fumes and without the length of time. It's so much faster with my inkjet printer. So Red River Paper, they have surfaces for everything, all the way from metallic sheets, high gloss, to this wonderful matte paper, a variety of matte papers, to fine art greeting cards, to fiber-based paper, ink for both Canon and Epson printers, and a ton of instruction. All of this over at their site. You can get to it by clicking on the tile on all the pages of the digital story, and also check out their Facebook page, facebook.com/redriverpaper. All right, that's going to do it for me this week. No more dilemmas, at least not for the moment. See what you think. You know, if you haven't shot HDR for a while, consider it again. And show some restraint and see what you can do. All right, I'm working on some great stuff for next week. Make sure you come back and join me. Until then, have a great week. Bye-bye now.